Good evening, and I hope everybody can hear me okay. This is a special event. It's the very first webinar organised by Mental Health Professionals Network, and we have quite a significant attendance tonight. We're going to start reasonably on schedule. We're hoping to pack quite a bit into tonight's meeting. By way of introduction, my name's Ajit Singh. I'm a psychiatrist based in Geelong in private practice, and also have a role in establishing a new medical school at Deakin University here in Geelong. And through that, we do a lot of online education and interactive tutorials. And I think it's with that background that I was invited to be a facilitator for tonight. And as I've said to the others, I see myself as the maitre d' and not the main course. We're very lucky to have three expert panellists join us. And we have Stephen Carbone, a GP based in Melbourne. He has a special interest in mental health presentations, and he also has a policy advisory role for Headspace. He'll be giving us a key perspective from the GP, who's very much, you know, the front door of care for a lot of people seeking help. We're also joined by Michael Carr-Gregg, who most of you will be aware from his appearances on television and radio. Michael is an adolescent psychologist private practice in Melbourne also, and he's got quite a long and interesting biography, including academic roles with Melbourne University in the past, and more recently having a anti-bullying education role for the Queensland Department of Education. And we're thirdly joined by Peter Parry, who is a child and adolescent psychiatrist based in Adelaide, who before going into psychiatry was grounded in some broad experiences, including general practice, some naval medical officer service, as well as palliative care. And he has some 15 years' experience as a psychiatrist in child and adolescent mental health services, both inpatient and outpatient, and as well as in Australia and the UK. The learning objectives of tonight, we're really keen to make it informative but interesting. Sometimes a combination doesn't occur. And it's really to have a focus on discipline-specific approaches to an adolescent depression presentation with a cyberbullying component, and to give people a more rich understanding of what are the intersections, similarities and differences between the different people involved. And then I think this whole process, I think, will hopefully be a model for interdisciplinary collaboration, which is actually one of the founding reasons for the Mental Health Professionals Network. Now, the process of tonight is there is a large number of attendees. There's 250 people have registered, so not everybody will be able to link up with voice or video. We've really restricted it to the panel and myself. What you can do is send text questions to myself, and at the end of the meeting, in the last 20 minutes or so, I'll take a selection of those questions and pose them to the panel. If you're comfortable, if you could briefly mention your name, the town you're in, and your discipline background, I can hopefully select a broad mix of geographic regions and discipline backgrounds in the questions. Ensure that your computer's muted so that you don't get any feedback. And afterwards, for those who've not been able to get their questions through, there's an online forum via the Mental Health Professionals website, so there's a second opportunity to have input if you can't get through. The session will be in three parts. Initially, for about 10 minutes or so, each of our panelists will give a brief overview of some key aspects of adolescent depression and healthcare delivery. And then we'll quickly move into a case presentation, the case of Tim tonight, which I think some, if not all of you, will have some of the text of that. To bring things to life. And during this process, I'll throw in a few questions just to liven things up and keep the panelists on their toes. And then in the last 20 minutes or so, there'll be time to inject questions that have been texted to me from participants. If you're having any technical difficulties, there is a phone number which you can call. I'll re-put that text up now. So without any sort of further ado, I'll pass on to our first speaker, who is Michael Carr-Gregg, who will be giving a brief overview of some of the epidemiology issues around adolescent depression.
Thanks very much, Arjit, and congratulations to the Mental Health Professionals Network for putting this on. This is clearly a very, very important issue, and just to provide some context for people, it's important to know that about 75% of all the sort of psychological problems in human beings generally occur before the age of 25, which is why, of course, the only psychologists that are really worthwhile are adolescent psychologists. One in four young people will in fact have a mental health problem prior to the age of about 18. But the really sad thing is, on the current studies, only 30% of young people will actually put up their hands and say, look, we've got a serious problem, I've got a serious problem. What has to be understood by all clinicians working with teenagers in this area is that they're heavily invested in not being different. First of all, at no other time in your life is the desire to be with your age mates so strong, but equally powerful is the desire to be normal. And that is a very powerful obstacle to not only help seeking, but even disclosure to close family and friends. And it's not really surprising then that about 50% of students with the most serious issues, according to Professor Michael Sawyer in his study in 2000, with the most serious psychological problems actually never get recognised. So that's generally not a good look. When we look at the epidemiology of these problems, what we see is that depression and anxiety actually account for over 55% of the problems. So while we probably talk a lot about substance abuse disorders, maybe even schizophrenia and personality disorders, in fact, anxiety and depression are the main game. And of course, as you will discover, very often they can co-occur, and in fact, in many instances, you will find that they can basically cross over. Depression tends to be seen most commonly in middle adolescence, and a lot of people ask me what middle adolescence is. Well, the definition of adolescence now is about 10 to 24. So around about the middle of that, you've got sort of peak prevalence. Officially, one in five, not one in four, one in five young people experience a diagnosable depressive disorder by the age of 18. And the real tragedy here is that overseas research suggests that some people can wait between 5 to 15 years before they receive treatment and care after the onset of their illness. Now, this is particularly problematic because early diagnosis and prompt treatment is associated with a much, much better outcome. So clearly, GPs, psychologists and psychiatrists working together makes a huge difference there. So what would it look like? How would you know if a young person presented with depression? Well, I did have one GP say to me that this kid couldn't possibly be depressed because they smiled when they walked into his consulting room. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. What we generally find is that depressed kids are indeed miserable most of the day, most of the time, persistently sad and downhearted. What you find is most young people have this sort of bounce back ability. These kids don't. When something bad happens, they don't bounce back. So even though they want to, they just don't seem to be able to have the psychological energy to do so. Also, these kids are very, very often on the brink of tears. They're sullen. They're out of sorts. You've got to look for fierce, uncharacteristic behavior. So the greatest predictor of future behavior in kids generally is past behavior. And when you've got a kid who just is completely out of sorts and behaving in a way that no one's sort of seen before, they think it's a little odd, that is definitely something to take notice of. We also know that depressed kids kind of lose interest in life. There's a wonderful term, anhedonia, which is sort of to lose the joy of life. And very often these kids have, you can ask them a very simple question. If you ask most kids, you know, what would happen if you won the lottery? Most kids, their faces light up and they'll say to you, wow, well, I'd buy this and I'd buy that. When I ask this kid this question of very depressed kids, they go, well, I suppose you can buy something, but they're not very enthusiastic about it. So these kids take very little pleasure in things that they used to enjoy. There's a lot of lethargy. When you ask them about their concentration, a standard question I ask is, can you concentrate long enough to read a book? And quite often these kids will say, no, I can't. Or even to watch a TV show or something on their computer, can you concentrate to follow the plot line? They'll say, no, I can't. So that decline in academic performance is a dead giveaway. If you've got a kid who's been going really well and suddenly there's a marked decline in their academic performance, you've got to be a little bit suspicious. The other thing is, I did mention early on that no other time in your life is the desire to be with your age mates so incredibly strong. And you will find that these kids will withdraw, not necessarily from all their social contacts, but from a lot of them. And that's kind of curious behavior for someone for whom adolescence and being with your friends is so important. The other thing is, these kids will engage in what we call introspective withdrawal, which is just psychobabble for spending a lot more time in their room or on their computer. And many of the kids will say to me, look, I'm literally not interested in interacting with my family. They do tend to be incredibly irritable, these kids, so there's quite a lot of conflict often in the household. So withdrawing to their room actually makes everybody happy. The other thing, of course, is that many of these kids, particularly when they haven't a clue what's going on or haven't shared with anybody what's going on, they will tend to medicate with alcohol, cannabis, ecstasy, or other drugs. And, of course, that tends to then cause additional problems, because many of those drugs will, in fact, exacerbate the condition. Physically, many GPs, in fact, get to spot these kids quite early on because they're often physically unwell. They'll have these somatic signs, headaches, tummy aches, other pains, and there doesn't seem to be an organic cause for them. Most of all, there's this sleep disturbance, there's this lack of energy, there's a change in appetite, either putting on or losing weight. The sleep disturbance is quite interesting. You can see some kids who just tell you they spend hours trying to get to sleep. Other kids will tell you, no, I go to sleep, but then I wake frequently during the night. And other kids tell me that they basically get into this pattern of early morning waking. Even though they're very tired, they can't get back to sleep again. And still others have your classic hypersomnia, where they just sleep all day. So over to Arjit, who provides the care.
I think I'll take that one on, Michael. So, as Michael said, I mean, the level of mental ill health or mental health problems in the teenage and young adult age group is quite high. If you look at last census, there's probably around about 3.7 million young people between the ages of 12 to 25 in Australia. Depending on, you know, what survey, the prevalence could be up to 27%. You're talking about over 900,000 young people with mental health problems. So who is there that can provide the care? Well, I guess there are a number of important health professionals that are available that do help out. For starters, there's probably around about 25,000 GPs in Australia, around about a similar number of psychologists, a much smaller number of psychiatrists, and an even smaller number still of Medicare registered social workers and OTs, even though clearly there's a number of social workers and OTs working in other settings such as community health and public mental health services who also provide care to young people through state-funded services predominantly. There's also a problem about the distribution of the workforce. Look, everyone knows that there's a problem both in numbers, workforce shortages, but the maldistribution of the workforce is a major problem in Australia. GPs are fairly well distributed. There's about 95 full-time equivalents per 100,000 in major cities, falling down to about 84 full-time equivalents in rural. Psychologists, well, a bit more unevenly distributed, certainly weighted more towards major cities and progressively falling away to inner city inner regional cities and small rural towns. And regrettably, with a small workforce, probably understandable, psychiatrists are very hard to come by outside of the major capital cities. So clearly, each person has a role. In 2007-2008, figures from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare suggest that around 3.5% of the Australian population saw a GP for a mental health problem. 1.3% saw a private psychiatrist. Half of that number saw a private psychologist, but with the changes to Medicare, particularly with the Better Access program, that figure has gone up quite substantially. And the minority would use a public mental health service, but they're spread through those sort of sectors. So by and large, most young people, if, you know, they don't seek help often, as Michael has said, and often talk to their friends or family or use school counsellors or whatever, but if they are seeing a health professional, it's often through a GP. But given the therapies that are often required for young people with mental health problems such as depression include some form of counselling or therapy, many will also need to be referred on to a psychologist or some other allied mental health worker, and sometimes also to a psychiatrist. So what's the role of the GP? Well, look, obviously we're often the first port of call. We see any and every health problem, and we're there to provide, you know, care across the lifespan. Sometimes people come in and clearly point out that they've got some sort of personal problem or psychological problem that they want help with, but often it's buried away, and you have to sort of, I guess, have a sensitivity to the possibility that, you know, this young person might be suffering from some sort of mental health problem, and opportunistically screen for it, ask for it, you know, check it out. So our role is partly around the assessment. This is tricky. We usually need time to do it. It often doesn't happen. People often book just a standard 15-minute appointment, which clearly isn't long enough to do all the work. So we may do a bit in one consultation and invite the young person back for a review fairly quickly or as quickly as we can to complete the assessment. Occasionally you get lucky and someone's booked a long appointment, but that's not usually the case. Also, I guess, you know, in terms of making a diagnosis or a formulation at least, you know, we try to put the pieces of the puzzle together and work out, well, what's going on here? Does this young person, you know, meet the criteria for a full-blown, you know, depressive illness? Or is it more a cluster of symptoms and psychosocial issues and contextual problems that are, you know, the sort of presenting problem? Sometimes that's clear straight away. Sometimes that only unfolds and becomes apparent over time. Like Michael says, you don't always get the full story in the one go, and sometimes, you know, the young person, as they get to trust you, might tell you more things about their issues as time progresses. And obviously we've got a role in management, either, you know, by providing the care ourselves or by facilitating and organising referral to other people who can support and help the young person. And obviously, you know, that depends on the type of problem, how complex it is, and critically, you know, what the risk issues are. So apart from treating the person yourself, we often refer to private psychologists or other mental health professionals, particularly now that better outcomes and better access, you know, are available. Although the stats show that young people are underrepresented in using these services still. So, you know, that's something we need to work on and try to improve. Engage more young people, the young people that need the help, and get them into the services they need. Private psychiatrists. In some locations, there are headspace sites, community health centres, public mental health services. So there's a few options, and it really depends on a whole host of things. You know, what's locally available? How expensive is it? What are the eligibility criteria? But critically, what does the young person want to do, and what will they agree to do? So I think I'll hand it over to Michael to talk about the role of the psychologist.
Yeah, well, you said it very, very well. We are greatly blessed by the being on Medicare and using better outcomes and the Medicare system. We are in a position to work very closely with GPs, and I've always regarded general practitioners really as the backbone of adolescent mental health care. And we're in a position, obviously, to follow through, most often for kids with depression, with cognitive behavioural therapy, interpersonal therapy. Some of my colleagues specialise in relaxation, hypnosis, a variety of evidence-based strategies which can be very, very useful. Over to you, Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. So I think the role of a psychiatrist, adolescent psychiatrist, is, of course, one of liaising with one's fellow professionals involved in the young person's care, as has previously been said by Steve and Michael. Also, I think it's always important to gather history as one can, maintaining a good rapport with and permission from the young person, with school staff and with their parents, other youth workers who might be involved. In order to be able to provide, as this slide says, a comprehensive biopsychosocial assessment. So that's, I suppose, the core part of training to be a psychiatrist around diagnosis is around this thing called a dynamic formulation, a biopsychosocial formulation about predisposing factors, precipitating factors, perpetuating factors, and protective factors around biological, psychological, social, and cultural domains, and you can get a kind of a 16-square grid. You don't write all that up, of course, but it's something that's going on in your mind. And the idea of a diagnostic formulation being a paragraph or two or three paragraphs, which puts all the factors in the right perspective so that you get an understanding of the real world of this young person and the things that have led to him to be depressed at this point in time. The DSM diagnosis is a much briefer, abbreviated form that is very important to make because it helps to say just how severe this problem is. But we can get a bit lost if we think that every depression is the same. It's an individual who we're seeing, and for every individual, it'll be different mix of those factors that leads to their depressive state. And that's why formulation in my opinion, many of my colleagues, trumps a simple diagnostic label. And so following from a thorough formulation follows a management plan that there might be more biological type factors around substance use and family history and melancholic features in the mental state, or it might be very much around psychological factors and very difficult early development with insecure attachment and a recent loss or something. And so you can kind of see where to aim things. And as we get to Tim's case and our discussion of that, maybe that will become a bit more apparent what I'm saying here. Another significant role, I suppose, because we see the hard end of mental health problems, mental illness, is around risk assessment. And I think nothing beats experience like experience in terms of assessing suicidality. One, unfortunately or fortunately, in a psychiatric career, gets a lot of experience assessing suicidality. So that's something we can offer to our GP and psychology colleagues who may not have had quite the level of experience.
Thanks for that, Peter, Michael and Steve. I think we may have had a little bit of a glitch with our slides loading. On my screen, we're not getting movement of the slides. Is that just isolated to me, or it's something that the others are noticing too?
I was seeing it, slide 15. It's now slipped back to slide 9.
Yeah, okay. Mine had been going ahead to in sequence.
Mine too.
I'm progressing.
Yep, it's on slide 15. That's where I was talking.
Yeah, really? So go back okay. to Peter with slide 15, yeah?
Okay. So,
so what we might do is we might actually segue now into the case. Thanks for that sort of overview. And the case that we have for today is the case of Tim. And we're going to run this in the sort of a real life sort of sequence, starting with his GP and then the processes that follow from that. And each panelist will give their clinical thinking around decision points. And I'll interject a few little things to keep everybody on their toes. The case for tonight is the case of Tim. Tim is a 17-year-old Year 11 student. He's the eldest of three. His parents have separated, and he lives with his mother and two sisters. He has regular contact with his father, and he presents really on the assistance of his mother, who's quite concerned about his irritability, apparent argumentativeness, not being helpful enough around the house, not interested in homework, falling grades, and she has concerns about him spending excessive amounts of time with his friends. And Steve, as Tim's GP, you've not seen him for some time. He's been in generally good health. The only issues you recollect is he was a little bit overweight and a little bit sensitive as a child, but nothing too severe. And his mum sort of brings you in. You're aware that she has a tendency to be anxious, and her ex-husband tended to be an unhappy man but was not clinically depressed. You're already running 20 minutes late. You've had to deal with a crisis chest pain and various other matters, and you realise that mum has just booked in a 15-minute consult for Tim, and your heart sinks. They're in your office. What do you do next?
Yeah, well, regrettably, a common scenario. Basically, what happens with Tim is, once you hear the story, you get the gist of what you need to do next. You have a quick chat to them both, but basically ask permission to start to speak to Tim on his own. Parents are sort of, vary about this, but Tim's mum was happy enough to wait in the waiting room whilst I attempted to start the conversation with Tim, tried to set him at ease, make him feel comfortable, and trying to sort of get some of the story without necessarily going into every last detail. After explaining issues of confidentiality, I just opened it up to Tim.
If I can interject there, it's a JD. When you say confidentiality, can you talk me through a little bit more about that? A 17-year-old, what's your kind of take on the confidentiality side of it?
Look, it's such a crucial thing for young people. I mean, they often are a bit scared about, who's going to be told what. And so I think you need to let them know that the conversation that you're about to have is between you and them, unless there are some risk issues. And those risk issues may be around the risk of self-harm and suicide or threats to harm other people. There may be risks related to sexual or other forms of abuse, which, you may have to report. And there's also issues around, what might happen if the young person winds up in some sort of court case and you may be asked to give evidence about their medical history. So you have to give some bit of an indication about the limits to confidentiality.
Yeah, I'm guessing, Steve, you get quite a bit of information being a skilled GP in your 15-minute window. What are some of the key bits of information that you elicit from Tim in that first consult?
So, look, the basic gist of Tim's comments was that, he believed his mother was making a mountain out of a molehill. He didn't really think there was a big problem other than that she was a constant nag. He was unhappy about her nagging and felt that might have contributed to Tim's father breaking up with her and leaving. And, he's a bit angry at her about that. By the same token, he's not overly thrilled with his father as well. He sees him as a bit unreliable and a bit more self-absorbed and interested in his own problems than maybe Tim or his sisters. Tim acknowledges that he is arguing with his mother every day, but again, doesn't necessarily see it as a problem, thinks that's commonplace and just one of those things that every teenager and their parents go through. So you sort of feel a bit blocked there, so you start to ask, some other questions about his general health and well-being, just to sort of get it back to a sort of a less threatening, sort of less complicated situation. He tells you that, he spends he doesn't sleep very much. He goes to bed around 2 a.m., wakes up at 7:30 to try to get to school, often very tired. He spends a lot of time on the internet, at night, either playing games or communicating with his friends. He's missed a bit of school in recent weeks. On the weekends, he sleeps in very late, His appetite's a bit patchy, but he hasn't lost any weight. He eats a lot of junk food. He also mentions that his schoolwork's fallen off. He's behind on several assignments. And one of the teachers is on his back and has said, look, if he doesn't pull his socks up, he probably is either going to have to repeat the year or find another school. Tim says that this person's just got it in for him and that they don't like students who don't do well because it brings down the Year 12 average and affects the school's reputation. He doesn't have a lot of extra participation in extracurricular activities, but he does work part-time at a fast food outlet. And up until recently, he was spending heaps of times with friends, you know, going over to someone's place at least three or four times a week, going to a party practically every weekend. You get the sense that he's sort of probably talked himself out, so you just want to check a couple of key things. He denies that he's feeling anxious or depressed, but admits he's stressed by, problems with his mum and problems at school. And he also mentions that he's had a bit of a falling out with one of his mates at school, and, you know, that's upset him of late. You inquire about suicidal ideation and, you know, there's some thoughts that, you know, oh, well, what the hell, you might as well just be dead, but no firm suicidal sort of intent or plan. And, look, he seems fairly tense and irritable, but that's about all you can get other than a slightly non-reactive affect.
Steve, do you think one of the key sort of things is, one of the basic resources in assessment is time, and do you think most GPs in this situation would reschedule for a long appointment to flesh things out?
Look, absolutely. I mean, it's very hard to get all the details. I mean, you want to get the gist. You want to do a risk assessment pretty clearly in the first interview. And if you're fairly confident that there's no pressing urgency, then the sensible thing is to get the young person back. It's tricky because it's a bit hit and miss. Sometimes you suggest that and there's an appointment made, but the young person doesn't return. But as long as you make it fairly reasonably soon and you collaborate with Tim's parents to sort of facilitate him sort of turning up, you know, you probably get your second chance, and then you schedule a longer appointment, a 30-minute block or something like that, and then you can get a more detailed history.
Steve, also, one of the things I sort of notice is we often depend on the GP at the back of their mind keeping alive organic differentials. In a sort of presentation like this, would you order sort of any blood tests or anything like that, or do you think as a routine screen it's not clearly indicated?
Look, one of the things I forgot to mention in Tim's presentation, you know, he was complaining of a lot of tiredness and fatigue, and although that's probably related to his sleep rhythm problems, you know, it is definitely worthwhile, you know, ordering some baseline tests, iron levels, a full blood, electrolytes, liver function, etc. I mean, more often than not, these things come back negative, but it's also a bit of a hook, because if you've asked the young person to do a blood test, it gives an excuse to sort of review them or get them back the later that week or the following week. So it's another good strategy. So it's always important to rule out physical conditions or organic conditions masquerading as sort of psychological problems, but often it's not the case.
And Steve, in that second consultation, he actually talks about the internet and cyber aspects of things that have happened at school. What sort of details does he give you?
Well, yeah, the follow-up consultation, I mean, I guess the story sort of becomes a bit more apparent. Probably the critical issue for Tim at this point is that he's had a pretty major falling out with his friends. Just for a joke, one of his friends, Max, started spreading a rumour that, he'd had sex with one of the, Tim called the less popular girls at the school. And, look, you know, Tim felt very embarrassed and humiliated by that. And then all of a sudden he's receiving a barrage of, phone, text, messages, emails, etc., Facebook sort of stuff, you know, that's teasing him and starting to become a bit derogatory and nasty. And look, in one of the weeks before he came to see me, he'd received this doctored image of him and this unpopular girl in a sort of compromised situation. And look, it obviously made him feel pretty embarrassed and humiliated. So that had led to a falling out with several members of his friendship group, a particular guy, Max, who I guess, was a bit of a dominant person in the group. But, you know, he managed to hang on to friendship with one or two of the group. But he felt a bit isolated from his peers as a result of that cyberbullying.
Steve, as a GP, you know, you're in a way the gatekeeper to care, and you'll get a lot of non-specific presentations. How do you make a decision as to whether, you know, somebody merits a referral? How do you go about that process to decide?
Look, it's an interactive thing. I mean, as I said before, sometimes people come and present and they specifically ask you for a referral, and they've identified themselves as having problems, or their family and they have identified a problem and request a referral, and more often than not, you'll facilitate that. In other situations, I guess it depends on what you assume to be the severity. You know, how much impact is this having on this young person's life? And the more, I guess, distress, and the more, I guess, what you might call disability, he's not turning up to school, he's falling behind in his academic performance, he's at risk of being, you know, told to repeat a year, get kicked out. I mean, these are sort of signals that it's a fairly sort of significant problem that requires more than just watchful waiting and a couple of GP appointments. It's probably something that warrants, you know, referral to a psychologist or other allied mental health clinician for, you know, more detailed assessment and then for management.
You wouldn't refer him directly to a psychiatrist?
Not at that point. I mean, I think, you know, if we're assuming that there's an adjustment disorder or depression or something like that, I think, you know, talking therapy, psychological therapies are clearly the first line. I might reserve, you know, a referral to a psychiatrist where there might be sort of complex diagnostic issues, or, you know, I want to inquire about whether medication should be used or not used. But in this particular case, no, I think referral to a psychologist would be a good next step.
Now, fortunately, Tim has seen Michael on the TV and likes the idea of going to see him. So he happily makes an appointment, and Michael is quickly available, which is terrific as well. And of course, this segues over to Michael. You get a brief letter from Stephen, sort of outlining issues, maybe a printout of the clinical notes as he races off to deal with a chest pain presentation, and you meet Tim for the first time. Can you take us through a little bit of your process with him?
Sure. Well, I thank the GP very much for his comprehensive letter of referral, and what I'm going to do is first of all deal with a very anxious mum, and I've got to get mum out of the room before I can talk to Tim. So I'll use a technique which I've used for many years, and that is I'll say, well, Mrs. X, before I talk to Tim alone, do you have any more questions? And when she tells me that she doesn't have any more questions, I have then presented as protocol that she's leaving. She didn't know she was leaving, but she's left, which is great. So now I've got Tim on my own. I'm mindful of the fact that young people tend not to be particularly sophisticated consumers of mental health care. So I'm going to make sure that he knows exactly who I am, what I do. I will also run through confidentiality as well, because I think that's a major obstacle to young people disclosing, and I will run through a diagnostic formulation which uses a five world model, and that is I'm going to try at the end of my consultation to be able to draw myself a little diagram that really examines in great detail Tim's perception of his five worlds, that is, how he gets on and how he perceives his family, how he's perceiving school, his friends, his inner world, and of course his digital world. And that's very important, because 60 to 90% of the socializing that young people do in 2010, of course, is digital. So in order to do that, I'll probably use a HEDS analysis, which is the standard Goldenring and Cohen Comprehensive Psychiatry 1988, I think they first came up with it. And that runs through, it's an interview, it's not particularly formal. I'll try and keep it as informal as possible, going through how he feels about home, school, his activities outside of school, the friends that he hangs out with, And then I will ask permission to ask more personal questions, particularly around drug and alcohol use, sexuality. And for this, I'll use a particular technique which many psychologists use called the many young people technique, which is where you say to Tim, many young people your age are experimenting with a variety of different substances. Tell me about your friends. What are they using? When he tells me what his friends are using, and most kids are very happy to talk about what their friends are doing, which of course is a risk factor in and of itself, depending on my reaction, which won't be sort of hysterical, my God, don't you know how bad those drugs are for you, nor that's fantastic, where can I get some, you sort of take a much more neutral kind of, well, that's interesting, and then you say, how about you? So you've indicated that you didn't come down in the last shower, you know that's what some young people do. And really what I'm interested in knowing is where, what he's using, how often, in combination with what, and most importantly, has his use increased recently, which is always a bit of a worry. With sexuality, because I'm really aware of the fact that many same-sex attracted kids do have significant levels of psychological problems. I'll talk to him a little bit about that as well. Many young people technique again. Many young people are experimenting with sexuality. Have you had a relationship with a girl, a guy, or both? So I keep it very gender neutral, obviously making no assumptions. So anyway, I've done that. I've formulated the balance of risk and protective factors in each of those worlds. And then perhaps I will have come to the conclusion that maybe he has something wrong with his cognitive map, something wrong with the way in which he explains the world to himself. And I'll try and help him identify his negative self-talk that perhaps are contributing to his feelings about school, family, and of course his friends, which is a major issue at the moment.
It's a genius, if I can interject. So it seems that, you know, the process of obtaining a history interdigitates with the therapy process as well. With people who've got sort of cyber stressors, are there cyber solutions as well? I know there's mention of certain websites that can assist.
Yes, indeed. And what I would be doing is trying to ascertain the nature of the problems he's having and assist him to learn how to deal with them, delete, block bullies, report harassment when it occurs. And in particular, I'd be directing him towards the cyber smart website, which has lots of useful resources for him, run by the Australian Communications and Media Authority.
Okay, so you've sort of started to engage with him. You've sort of had six sessions, and you're making some headway. At this point, through the Better Access Scheme, there's a need to sort of report back to Stephen as the GP, he goes back to see you, Stephen, and gives sort of a positive update about, you know, how he's going with his sessions with Michael. And he also expands a little bit of the history. And I wonder, Stephen, if you could outline some of the things that happened in that review session after six sessions with Michael.
Yeah, thanks, Ajit. So basically things are going, reasonably well with Michael. Tim does seem to be progressing, albeit maybe a little bit slowly. Look, unexpectedly, another issue comes up at the mental health review. It's important, obviously, to check out where things are at, but also just to, you know, go back a step and just re-ask some questions, and particularly around risk assessment. And during that consultation, Tim mentions that he's been, you know, hearing a voice occasionally, a male voice in his head occasionally, sort of towards the time he's sort of going off to sleep, often sort of somewhat derogatory comment like "you're useless" or "what's the point?" You ask a few more questions about possible perceptual disturbances. There's nothing really hard. Maybe once having thought he saw a vision of a deceased grandfather. You ask about other possible psychotic symptoms. he mentions, you know, feeling a bit paranoid, but it seems that he means that, you know, he's self-conscious and worries that people are just talking about him. But occasionally when he's used cannabis and, you know, he reported at the first consult that he, the second consult that he, you know, drank quite heavily in binges and used a bit of marijuana. At those times he has been a little bit more paranoid. And you also know that there is a family history of bipolar, a paternal uncle. You've known that from past history and working with his parents.
Stephen, so, if I can interject at the Jeet here again, do you get many presentations of people saying they hear voices?
Look, it's I guess it's a tricky one. There are some instances where when you've got time and you're doing a thorough assessment, obviously it's one of the questions you're going to ask. You know, most people will say no. But occasionally, you know, people will have some sort of minor perceptual disturbance. It doesn't always signal some sort of psychotic illness, but it's obviously one of those things that you want to sort of assess further, given that, you know, anxiety, depression can sometimes be the prelude of a, you know, a prodrome of a psychosis. And, you know, if people have brief sort of limited psychotic sort of symptoms under the influence of drugs and there's a positive family history, I mean, you know, it could suggest an at-risk mental state. It's worthwhile just maybe getting an opinion about that. But, no, it's not a common thing unless you ask for it.
And, Steve, it's here again. One of the things that, you know, I think that happens is people get demoralised while they stay unwell or only partially better. I guess progressive repeat risk assessment, you know, is an important sort of thing. And I think in Tim's case at the review, this is an area that you look into. Has there been any shift in his risk ideations when you review him?
There does seem to also have been a slight increase. I mean, he's now started to think more about the concept of taking his own life, but again, there doesn't seem to have been any firming up of a clear intent or plan. Occasional thoughts, he can dismiss them. He doesn't want to give his friends the satisfaction of, you know, having beaten him, but occasionally, you know, when, you know, the cyberbullying sort of comes up again, you know, he does feel that sort of sense of helplessness and wonder, well, what's the point? But there has been some degree of escalation of his suicide risk as well.
Now, one of the things, Steve, we touched on before at the initial presentation was, you know, whether to refer and the sort of logic around that, and I think a lot of the audience would be very interested in your thoughts at this sort of decision point, which has obviously been crafted into the case about decision points, whether there's further referral for Tim.
Look, I guess, you know, Tim is not an uncommon sort of patient. I mean, people often are going to see a psychologist, and look, many will just need that and do certainly improve and things get sorted out. But there are a subgroup where you're not quite sure if they're heading in the right direction and you hear more bits of information. And if, particularly if the stressors are ongoing or there's a new stressor that comes along in the mix, you know, it can tip the balance backwards again. And look, when there's issues around, well, is this the right diagnosis? Is the person getting better? May they need something else on top of the psychological therapies? You know, I think that's often a point when you might call in a psychiatrist. That said, it's all about availability, and, you know, if there's someone available, you're going to call on their help. If there's not, you might use, you know, other means like the psych support service that the College of GPs runs, you know, or, you know, you might be left, as many country doctors are, sort of figuring it out for themselves and taking a punt. So, but, you know, in our area, there are psychiatrists. There are also state-funded child and adolescent mental health services. And
now, Steve, I might butt in again, Judy. And so I'd like to pose a question to Michael as well. If you were seeing somebody and they started to report more worrying phenomena or more worrying risk issues, maybe they hadn't disclosed it to anybody else, maybe as a psychologist they were disclosing more to you, how do you see your role in sort of shaping referral?
Well, I would discuss with a young person the need for a referral to someone who has expertise in this area. I would clearly disclose that's not me, and I would talk to him about what the options were. If he was comfortable with my referring him back to the GP to do that, that's what I'd do. If, on the other hand, I already knew a really good psychiatrist in my area who was happy to see him, what I'd do is I'd talk to his mum about getting a referral from the GP to that person. I try not to have them see too many different specialists in that state. I'd like them just to make a seamless transition. But I'd certainly be liaising through the GP.
Okay, so I think we're at a point in the sort of case where using the goodwill capital that Steve and Michael have, they've convinced Tim to go along and see a psychiatrist. It's sometimes a difficult sell, I imagine. Fortuitously, there's a cancellation in a reasonable timeline, and Peter's the kind of psychiatrist who likes to make himself available, and the referral comes through to your office, and appointment's made, and Tim and his mother come along. What's your process, Peter, as a psychiatrist?
Yeah, well, Tim's a very common kind of presentation, actually. And I'm fortunate in this particular case of Tim in that confidentiality issues, and he's had a good experience. There is goodwill capital that that has been picked up from his experience with seeing Steve in the very tactful way that Steve kind of lured him into having a therapeutic experience, and of course with Michael as well. I do something very similar around confidentiality discussion and seeing his mother with him for part of the session, but throw in the Michael question at some point, have you got any more questions, Mrs. whatever her name is, and before I see Tim on his own, and so then I see Tim on his own too. I would be taking the classic Maudsley style history, but adjusting
my
language.
Can you explain that a little bit for us? What is a Maudsley?
Well, it comes from the Maudsley Hospital in London, and it's the standard history where you make sure you cover every base, that you're going to ask questions about OCD, about eating disorders, about psychotic symptoms, and about neurovegetative functioning, about suicidal intention, in addition to ideation. And you're also going to cover the family history background, and you're going to cover the developmental history, which is very important. And at some point, I would like to see his mother, perhaps on her own for a little bit of time, to really find out what was really going on in the marital relationship prior to his birth, through the pregnancy, the early attachment factors, whether she had postnatal depression, whether it was domestic violence. And it seems actually in Tim's case there was a bit of that. And it had been a fairly unhappy kind of marriage, and Tim had been exposed to a lot of this at a young age.
To interject again, Peter, I guess often what happens is we get too busy to liaise. I certainly know I wish I liaised more frequently. Would it be one of the steps initially also, maybe if time permitted, to give a call to Michael or Steve if it was part of the assessment that you were concerned about? Is that something we do enough?
No, it's something we certainly don't do enough, and it's part of the modern world and lack of time. But I would imagine I'd be fortunate from having had a good referral letter from Steve and also a copy of Michael's letter back to Steve. And there might be issues in those that I need to know more about, and it would obviously be a good thing to give them a call to clarify.
Yeah, it's reasonable, would you say, that you'd be CCing all your letters to Michael and
absolutely,
Steve? And
yeah.
I think that can be something that's very simple but effective.
And letting Tim and his mother know that, you know, we're a team, we're working together here to help Tim get his life back where he wants it to be.
Do you think you can figure him out in that one-hit session, pays better, or do you think you'd probably do it over a few sessions?
I'd do it over a few sessions.
Yeah, I think sometimes the referrals come in just to do a one-off assessment, but I suppose sometimes it doesn't lend itself to such. Would you do many one-off assessments, or would most of them be a sequence?
I do a fair few one-off, but they're not really one session one-offs. And so, you know, my role there is to do a good assessment and management plan and hand it back to the GP and the psychologist or other helping professionals in the young person's life. But just to do something all in one session, yeah, sometimes you can do that when the problems are fairly straightforward, but generally it's more than one session. And I also like to give a kind of a little spiel that I've sort of developed over the last few years after attending a few conferences and about what is depression, how does it occur? And so it's a little bit of an educative thing I do on a whiteboard, and I take on a kind of a school teacher-y type role. And it's around, you know, why does getting good sleep matter? You know, what is relaxation? What is stress? What causes depression? And so I draw a picture of the brain, and I draw things like the amygdalas and talk about the fight, flight, freeze response. And that if you're in kind of a chronic state of worry, that it can run your brain cells down into a depressive state. I talk a little bit about attachment theory, how we're a tribal species, a social species, and getting on well with others, you know, was important for the evolution and survival of the human race. And so there's kind of a negative side to the positive side of that history of our species is that when you're not getting on, you've got to feel painful because you want to actually rejoin and get things going well in your relationships. And a little bit about rank theory and how, you know, if you're feeling you're down the bottom of the pecking order, you want to get back up it, and if it doesn't feel good down the bottom of the pecking order. And then that might link, you know, for Tim into the fact he does miss his father and he does feel like, you know, the way that Dad left, you know, wasn't good. And then, you know, there's the thing about this girl that it does turn out he was a bit keen on her and he was made fun of for being keen on her. And
it's just a jeep butting in here again. So Pat, during your assessment, he kind of mentions these voices. And he also mentions, you know, he wishes he was dead. What do you do with that?
Yeah, well, soft psychotic features, that, just as Steve said, they're actually a lot more common than probably given than people would commonly give credence to. And probably about 80 to 90% of kids who have quite strong soft psychotic features like this never go on to develop a psychotic illness as such. These are features that are indications of sleep deprivation, transient effects perhaps of intermittent cannabis use, and features of being depressed as well. His auditory hallucinations, I explore them. I find out that they're very much second person, derogatory, directed just to him. I've heard a bit from his mother and also from him that it sounds a bit like, well, you know, from a psychodynamic point of view, that his father's voice is kind of echoing there somewhere in his subconscious too. His father's a very critical, negative man, as Steve was talking about earlier, and is in the longer written thing that people listen to this webinar can access afterwards. So,
Peter, what's your approach with the risk assessment
side
of things?
Yeah, and well, with the risk assessment, he's not got any plans. He's not actually ever made any attempts. His intent seems still to be low, but there is this kind of feeling, I wish I wasn't here. I personally sometimes kind of talk about having seen many people over many years who are suicidal, and some have really tried to actually take their lives. And virtually all of them after a period of time are just so glad that they didn't because they feel well again. They're over their depression and, hey, glad to be around again. And that it's important in a way people honour their future self by realising that suicidal ideas can be very strong, but they are often a temporary, transient thing, and that there is this saying that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, and it's not logical, it doesn't sort of make sense. I mean, I'd say all that at the right time, you know, judging where Tim's at and how strong our rapport is. Talk about the brain as being a problem-solving organ, as it were. And so it looks for, you know, if this door doesn't open for me, I look for another door. And the suicidal ideas are like, well, we feel stuck at the moment. And so there's the exit door, it's kind of a natural kind of thing that happens to people. But, hey, the other doors do open in time, and so it's important not to ever take the exit door.
Now, it's just a Jude here again. So we've got, Tim, he's seen three healthcare professionals. Do we have 100% certain diagnosis, being devil's advocate? And what's your sense of how to work the diagnosis side with a case like Tim?
Well, I think Tim has depression. Depression, in diagnostic terms, is an ongoing debate in psychiatry, and I think DSM-5 is going to shift the deck chairs around again to non-melancholic, melancholic and psychotic is the latest I've heard. I would see that Tim does not have a melancholic or psychotic depression, despite these few soft psychotic features or pseudo-psychotic features. He's got a very classic mixed bag kind of adolescent depression with a handful of neurovegetative features and some passive suicide ideation. It's important to recognize
Is there a place for adjustment disorder with depressed mood here?
There is. He's had this humiliating experience, you know, with the cyberbullying of him and the other girl and the doctored image. He's had the falling out with Max, who he describes as having been his best friend. Max seems to be one of those lads who is top of the pecking order in the schoolyard. And I think, you know, again, coming back to look the long view as well and the full formulation, I'd be thinking in my own mind about the falling out with Max and the falling out with his own father. I'd be thinking about the ambivalent relationship with this girl who he has admitted to Steve he was keen on, and the ambivalent relationship he has with his mother, who's a real nag, he says. And yet he's kind of, you know, come in there and his father's off the scene, and his mum has become over-involved in his life, as a lot of these mums often do with their sons when the relationship with the father's been very sad and disappointing. And there's a bit of a pseudo-marriage between the mother and the son, which Tim unconsciously feels very uncomfortable about.
You're in the referral letters also made a comment about is there a role for medication. What are your thoughts in this sort of case?
Well, in the 1990s, I would have reached for a script patent prescribed an SSRI probably quite quickly in this case. And I think a lot of my colleagues were doing the same. Unfortunately, and it's rather a scandal, which perhaps any of the people listening to this webinar are aware of, but the literature around the antidepressants has been oversold by sponsored drug trials, and there's been a few prominent papers recently around this. I think one by Fournier et al. In I had that somewhere. That in fact, when all the data has been presented, there's a paper by Eric Turner on this, that you find that they don't seem to be placebo in mild to moderate depression. Now, the other thing is, though, is placebo effect is reasonably good. And however, then one has to balance that with the fact that SSRIs for adolescent boys, and you sometimes see this when you ask the right questions, that they get that delayed ejaculation, some to the point of great frustration. So they might be masturbating, they just can't climax. As one lad said to me the other day, is that these pills I'm on? And there is some evidence around growth hormone suppression, disturbances with spermatogenesis, osteoporosis, perhaps in long term, minor side effects of gastrointestinal upset and headache. The thing that's most worrying is the agitation reaction that can have someone have quite uncharacteristic, strong suicidal ideation and urges, and also aggressive or even homicidal ideation and urges. And as to how common that is, depends what you read, but somewhere between about 1 in 40 to 1 in 160 people on SSRIs might experience that. And I have seen patients over the years who have talked about having had that experience on an SSRI. I don't know if you have, Archie.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one of these sort of things one of my sayings is brains ain't brains and minds ain't minds, and I think our first step we need to be sort of led by the evidence. But there's always that case that does very badly or very poorly with any particular approach. I think when you're seeing, Tim, what emerges is, as well as the social difficulties, particularly at school and with a bit of the cyberbullying, he's also got quite a unhealthy lifestyle.
Mm.
What's your sense? Is that just an irrelevant minor factor, or do you see
No. I see that as, and talking to colleagues in peer review groups, if we can get these kids to just go to bed early, to exercise enough so they're tired enough and they sleep better at night. Now, of course, you know, the sleep disturbance is part of his depression, it's part of his unhappiness, it's part of his ruminating, it's part of his sense of humiliation and shame and all of that. So the cognitive kind of therapies that Michael's talking about are important. But just simple lifestyle stuff. And what I've found, again, helps is to actually use the evolutionary paradigm, get up there with the whiteboard and the textures, and I draw a picture of the brain and some of the internal organs, and talk about the fight-flight response and the importance of slow diaphragmatic breathing, that based on yawning and sighing, sobbing and laughing, this kind of Valsalva sort of maneuver that triggers the vagus nerve that turns off, and they draw these pictures. It's an oversimplification, but basically you turn off the amygdalas and calm the brain stem, and then the body can calm down, and then you can get to sleep. And hey, the frontal lobes function better, and you're less kind of, you know, sort of focused on worry thoughts. And you get that relaxation experience, and I show that, you know, this correlates with going from beta rhythm into alpha rhythm states on the EEG. Sort of bamboozle kids with a bit of science, but at a simplified level. And then I demonstrate, and I say, look, I'm going to show you how to do this yoga-type breathing, and I do it, and I look like a fool, and I say, but at least I'm a relaxed fool. And I talk about animals, like the use of yawning by dogs to avoid fights, and chimpanzees use it, and it's contagious, and the whole tribe calms down. And horses use the kind of sort of sigh to, again, trigger their vagus nerve and calm themselves down, because they're very skittish kind of animals. So I really, because often they've said, oh, yeah, in grade five, some teacher taught us how to breathe, but it never worked for me. And I said, well, have you ever yawned? Have you ever sighed? That does work. And, you know, that, and so if you just do this breathing like a yawn, and you do sets of 10 while you're lying in bed at night, and I draw a picture of, you know, the stress from 0 to 10, 10 total terror, 0 complete calm, and how you're lying in bed and you're 6 out of 10, so you're not going to get to sleep, and then you worry and you get frustrated because you still can't get to sleep, and oh, before you know it, you're up to a 7.5 or an 8, and then you remember, oh, that Dr. Parry is crazy breathing, and so you then take a slow diaphragmatic breath, and on the out-breath, you know, you just feel yourself sinking into the pillow and the mattress, and you come down a little bit, and then you do another one. Now you relax from where you've just relaxed to, and stepwise, 10 breaths in a row, hey, you've come from 6 out of 10 down to 4 out of 10. And
now, Peter, it's just Ajit here interjecting.
But
as a psychiatrist, when would you consider prescribing an antidepressant? And do you have some kind of sense of situations where you might consider it? Or are there particular aspects of Tim's case where you wouldn't consider it, and could you sort of outline that in brief?
Yep. Okay. The melancholic kind of psychomotor retarded depressed kids who are, they're much more common in adult psychiatry. You see very few of them in child psychiatry or in adolescent psychiatry, but occasionally you do. And I would be on the side of prescribing early in those cases. The kids with the more common Tim-like depression who you've been treating for quite a number of weeks, and they are trying, you know, get their circadian rhythm right by getting up and getting sunlight and building their melatonin levels so they sleep better at night, and they're doing the breathing relaxation, but they're still profoundly depressed, and the suicidality is a worry. After a period of time, I think, well, look, you know, there are certain kids in these drug trials like the TAD study, the Treatment of Adolescents with Depression study run by the NIMH in the UK, sorry, in the USA, which so that the smallest group of the more severely depressed kids did seem to respond to fluoxetine, albeit that the response wasn't that huge, but it was significant. So I prescribed there. So it's very much a second, third line kind of thing for the typical adolescent depression. And then the other group is the severe OCD, obsessive compulsive disorders, where you do see, it does seem that the SSRI is having a more direct effect on that.
Now, Peter, it's Ajit here again. So you've decided against medication, you're pushing lifestyle, you're pushing psychoeducation, resilience. Is there a role for you to speak to people at school? It seems that Tim's been threatened with being ejected from school if he doesn't lift his game.
Yes.
Is there a role for that, or is that overkill? And
not at all.
Is it a bit prickly to do or easy to do?
Well, it's prickly to do depending on your rapport with the young person, and often it is. But, you know, you just develop trust, you know, their trust, and you find out that there are a lot of issues at school, and you say, well, look, you need to kind of get a bit more information from the school counsellor. They say, well, don't talk to that school counsellor. I say, okay, well, who do you get on? Oh, well, the deputy principal, this male teacher, he's not a bad bloke. Okay, so we'll talk to him. And so, say in Tim's case, I phone and I find out, you know, that he is struggling, that he is possibly facing having to repeat his year 11. Max and all his mates are going to be in year 12 looking down on him next year. He's a sensitive kind of kid who's been browbeaten by his dad all his life. He doesn't respond well to feeling looked down upon. It's part of the rank theory reason why he's feeling depressed. So I say, well, look, I'll give Mr. So-and-so a call if that's okay with you. And so we do that and talk to him, and I find out if I write a letter saying Tim has been suffering depression, that they're going to actually base his year 11 results more on work he did earlier in the year when he wasn't depressed and he was scoring quite well, and they're going to discount a lot of his recent exams and his missed assignment. Hey, he's going to be able to pass through to year 12, but he's going to have to do a bit of revision over the school holidays just so he doesn't start year 12 behind the eight ball.
Okay, now just to sort of segue into time to sort of throw some questions up to the panel. So after those tremendous inputs, starting with GP, psychologist, and inputs with Peter as a psychiatrist, Tim starts to turn the corner. He's changed his lifestyle. He's lost a few kilos. He started to date that girl that others were criticising him about. Things are moving in the right direction. A happy ending in this case. It doesn't always go that way. I guess my first sort of question, you know, to all three of the panelists is, you know, their sort of sense or experience of how often these sorts of presentations go well and how often they can go downhill badly.
Look, if I might start, I think there's a couple of issues with clients like Tim and the care we provide them. And I guess to some extent we've presented the ideal scenario, but unfortunately it doesn't always pan out like that. First of all, from the GP's end, as we said initially, if you don't spend that time, you know, building sort of engagement, you know, trust and rapport, Tim's probably not going to come back. And it's a tricky thing in general practice because you don't, you know, that often takes time to develop, and you don't always, young people don't always feel comfortable about coming back. But if you get to that point, then things often progress much, much better. And then, you know, if they trust you, then they're more willing to sort of take the next step. Because selling the psychologist and selling the psychiatrist are not always easy, although young people are much more, I guess, savvy now, and probably, even though there is still that reluctance and, as Michael said, the desire, the need to sort of be normal, I guess they've seen or heard or know, you know, of other people, other friends, you know, who have gone down that track and, you know, and maybe, you know, are willing to do so themselves. I think that whole issue that, you know, we started with, you know, trying to work out our respective roles, but also to keep each other in the loop. That's another point at which things fall down. You know, we do get letters back, that's good, but they're not always the sort of letter that's helpful. It's either too much information or doesn't cut to the chase for what a GP needs to know. I mean, we do have to trust that our colleagues know what they're doing, and they do, and so to some degree we can leave it to them and you know, have a fair degree of confidence that things will work out, but it's very important to be kept in the loop and And there's nothing worse than, you know, finding out second or third hand from someone that something's been done without the GP sort of being sort of informed about it all. And I guess that's a bit of a bugbear for GPs, not sort of, we're not intending to hand over care, we're intending to sort of be the main caregiver, but bring in experts, professionals with particular expertise into the loop. And we don't mind, you know, that we trust them to do the right thing, but we just want to be sort of kept informed. And, you know, also, so it gives us a chance to talk to the client, the patient, like Tim, to check out if they're happy with the way things are progressing, because we're going to be there for the long haul, and it's very important that, you know, once Tim gets better, there's always a risk that he could relapse down the track, and the person he's going to go to is back to me, not back to the psychologist or the psychiatrist necessarily in the first instance.
That's right. There's no escape for you, Steve. You know, you're at the front line. One question I want to pose to Peter as the psychiatrist. Sometimes is the role of the psychiatrist to say, I'm not needed?
Oh, yeah. Or that I've done my bit, which may have been the case for Tim. After three sessions, I was very happy to hand him back to Steve. And for a bit of further work with Michael, that may have been around some getting his father in and helping to repair that relationship, but that might be beyond things. Steve might be better with that because Steve might see Dad and know about his drinking problem and his history and have a better rapport with him.
Yeah, but I think sometimes being a psychiatrist myself, sometimes I think we serve the role of excluding things and sometimes a medico-legal role, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And I think if there's a life at risk, maybe particularly a young life, thorough is good. And, you know, sometimes a psychiatric review is I'm happy with how things are going, and that can actually back up others. If the psychiatric opinion came back that, you know, this is an adjustment disorder, you should continue with your psychological counselling approach, that might give a lot of backup to, you know,
definitely.
Michael. I mean, do you think that's a useful function for a one-off psychiatric opinion at times?
Oh, absolutely, no question about it. I'd also argue that the, as in respect to your original question about whether or not this is going to be a good outcome, I think the single most important factor is, first of all, establishing a great rapport with the young person so you really convince them that you understand where they're coming from and you're interested in them so they feel safe and valued and listened to with you. And secondly, the communication stuff. The information that I would have got from the psychiatrist would have been absolutely invaluable, and that communication crucial. The other thing is to make sure that the parents are in the loop, and I think we tend to overlook that sometimes with adolescents. I go out of my way, or would go out of my way with Tim, to convince him that one of his greatest resources, in fact, is Mum, and that getting his permission to just keep Mum in the loop would be very, very important, and I'd be encouraging him to allow me to do that.
Now, some of the questions coming from the audience are about sort of early signs of cyberbullying. Things that the victim can do to try and stem it before it presents clinically. If I can throw that to the panel, if they've got any views on that.
Sure, well, I might take that to begin with. I mean, cyberbullying is basically bullying in cyberspace, usually most commonly via text message, occasionally through social networking sites and general computer use. What I tend to try and do is teach the kids to block and delete in the first place and, of course, to report abuse. I would also urge them to bring it to the attention, particularly if it's school-related, to the school authorities. And quite often they're very reluctant to do that. But I do try to explain to them that even though it's happening from the comfort and safety of their own home, all schools now have an acceptable use policy. Bullying is a violation of that, and they really are obliged to let them know.
Okay. I guess one of the things I like is I like positive psychology. I like the positive psychology movement. And, you know, another twist which is coming through in the questions is overcoming a depression as a as an engine room for resilience, as an engine room for development. Is there a trap of medicalizing and pathologizing a lot of things when they present in this way?
I I like to use this kind of evolutionary paradigm, and that depression actually has a reason, a rationale, and that when you understand that, you can see ways through it, and those ways through it make you a stronger person. And sometimes I say, you know, other people I've seen, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, Ajit, what was the rest of that question?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a thread of questions coming from the audience that I guess maybe sometimes normalising difficulties and that actually enables people to develop resilience. I guess it's a juggling act. I mean, would panellists say, you know, certain cases like this, they'll actually be far better for getting through the experience? Do you see that?
Oh, I'd certainly agree with that. I think, you know, one of the great realisations for young people is that random and chaos happens in the universe. And there's some things that we just don't have any control over. But as a cognitive behavioural therapist, I would really want to get them to understand you can't really have a feeling unless you first have a thought. And you are in control of your thoughts. If you think about, learn to think about things differently, then you can actually not only behave differently, but then you'll feel differently. And teaching him to recognize those unhelpful thoughts that contribute to his feeling lousy, I think that's a fabulous thing, not just for the current presentation, but for the rest of his life.
Yeah, look, I'd echo that. I mean, obviously, when, you know, you see young people then years down the track that might have been a patient at one particular point for this particular problem, and you can see that, you know, they've progressed and they're using some of the learnings and particularly that the cognitive behavioural therapy learnings of, you know, just double-checking what they're thinking and sort of making sure that sort of it's more rational than irrational or whatever terminology you want to use. It does become incorporated into a sort of, a new way of looking at the world, and that is obviously protective and can be quite helpful for people. So if they pick that up, it does protect them for the future.
Another sort of thread of questions, if the Tim in this case, if he's just the identified patient and there may be emotional disturbance in one or other parent, is this kind of a scenario that presents?
Well, look, absolutely, and look, as the sort of history sort of alludes to, Tim's father is, a guy who I guess has sort of had a sort of chronic to sort of dysthymic sort of outlook on life and a chip on his shoulder and I guess a problem drinking, a drinking problem, attempts to sort of engage him haven't always been sort of fruitful, but, you know, he's made a few fits and attempts, but regrettably sort of hasn't sort of turned the corner in that. But, you know, there are clearly other factors at play that I guess a GP would be aware of, but, you know, knowing what to do or being able to encourage people to deal with those issues isn't always easy.
Is another thread of questions, is family therapy becoming a lost art?
Well, it's just I'll leave that to the others, but it's about availability in some cases.
Michael or Peter, your thoughts?
Well, I certainly can tell you that I don't think it is a lost art. I think I would be working on an individual level with mum, because what I actually find is that many mums of kids this age don't actually understand the developmental psychology of adolescence. And what we can do is teach them how to parent an adolescent, teach them about negotiation, about compromise, teaching them to fight over things that matter, to have a way of communicating with them which is adolescent-friendly, not to recognise that these young people have a sensitivity to control. So I'd be working with that, but I also think it might be useful to refer to family therapy, but that presupposes, of course, that Dad will be interested. But I'll over to Peter.
I think in Tim's case, family therapy, if all three members, both parents and Tim, could be got to that, to readiness for that, would be excellent and could involve some very deep healing for this lad from his developmental traumas. But as Michael said, you'd want to do a bit of preparatory work with mum, and Steve might be perfectly placed to do a bit of preparatory work with Dad. and then you might see them dyadically, you know, Tim and Dad, and then Tim and Mum, and maybe then Dad and Mum together, and a lot of shuttle diplomacy in my experience in, with families eventually bears fruit.
Look, I think it's also, it touches on the what Peter and Michael and Jeet, you've said, you know, about the situation with Tim. I mean, there's an ideal and there's sort of what you might only be able to achieve given the circumstances, and clearly the more holistic you can make the sort of intervention, both with the physical health stuff, and Peter's touched on some of that stuff around diet and exercise and sleep hygiene, and you know, the individual work with Peter, the individual work with his mother, the sort of any sort of family intervention, but also that liaison with the school, and also, you know, helping, you know, I guess Tim to sort of you know, with some of his sort of interpersonal skills and, you know, his connections to other things outside of, you know, school and his part-time job, you know, into hobbies and recreation or other situations where he can engage with peers. But there's a certain minimum that you have to achieve, and then there's the ideal that you'd like to achieve, and I guess somewhere in between is often what happens.
Okay, well, look, I think we're coming close to time. Tim does well. He has a healthier lifestyle. He starts to play sport. He starts to go out with that girl he likes. Stops blaming others for his problems. He touches base with the GP a year later, and he says, it's interesting, Mum and Dad have changed as well too. Dad doesn't always complain that he's a victim these days. And Mum's lost some weight too, saying, if you could do it, I can do it. So with a really rosy, ideal world ending, maybe we can actually help more than one person if we get adolescents on the right track. I think tonight's been just a great sort of platform to discuss things. I think the technology has run pretty smoothly, and hopefully this will be the first of many to really enable really good access to high-quality panellists such as tonight. I'd like to thank Michael, Stephen and Peter for their attendance and participation tonight and putting together a lot of background work. And I'd certainly like to thank all the attendees for taking time out. We have 111 attendees at the moment, assuming my screen is correct. So that's a good volume. I think also a vote of thanks to Mental Health Professionals Network, Nikki, Sarah and some of the others who've really been involved in setting this up. We'll conclude punctually to enable life-work balance for all those who wish. And when we close this session, there will be an exit quiz that will come up. This will assist further webinars and also will assist the CPD validity of this evening for your various specialist bodies. And I'd like to close by, you know, inviting you to the next one, whenever that may be, and inviting you also to consider logging on to the Mental Health Professional Network's website, which will have a forum continuing now and hopefully field further questions. I thank you all and good evening.